Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And this is Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to Seriously. We've been looking through the emails and we've had two requests for recommendations from us this week in a sort of reversal of our usual email format. We've had a lovely email from Ashley, who got in touch because he enjoyed the female friendship week we did a few weeks ago. But he said, as a man with a female best friend, I would love to know your feelings on male-female friendships and if any cultural depictions are actually representative. I can't think of a single depiction in culture which reminds me of a natural relationship between a man and a woman which seems real, which isn't the gay best friend. I've thought about this, and all the examples I can think up, I think, tend to fall into that gay best friend area.
Yeah, same. I mean, we were just thinking, so like Titus and Kimmy in The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, I think, is a really nice depiction of a woman and her male friend who is gay.
Yeah, so we also thought of Alana and her roommate from Broad City, Hannah and Elijah from Girls, which actually fails at desexualizing their relationship, and he's her gay best friend, so it's kind of like the worst of both worlds.
Yeah.
So I really struggled with this. Did you think of any that you liked?
Well, I thought of one, but it's far from perfect and the show it's in is not very good, so I don't feel like it's a great recommendation, which is I quite like and I'm interested by the relationship between Sheldon and Penny in The Big Bang Theory, although that doesn't quite work, I think, for this, in the sense that she is a sort of sexual character and that she's the girlfriend of another character, not Sheldon's girlfriend. Their friendship is nice and they talk about stuff that doesn't get talked about anywhere else in that show.
I hate The Big Bang Theory with my life,
so
but
do
that
I.
is a good element of an otherwise terrible show, I guess. So yeah, do let us know if you have any thoughts on this, because I'd actually be really interested, because obviously the first thing I thought about was like, oh, When Harry Met Sally, but obviously the whole point of that film is that
men and women can't be friends.
Exactly.
Yeah, or the other thing is, I suppose, Friends. But then the writers kind of polluted all potential for successful men-women friendships in that by constantly like upgrading them to potential romantic relationships and then downgrading them when they didn't play well with viewers.
Definitely. We'd like some more suggestions, so do get in touch.
Seriouslypod@gmail.com or Twitter and Facebook if you have any better thoughts than us on this. We've had another request for recommendations from Rachel, who says, I'm another enthusiastic American fan of Seriously. Besides being funny and smart, it gives me lovely, warm, fuzzy flashbacks to my study abroad in East Anglia and being steeped in sometimes puzzling British popular culture. Do you have any recommendations for things specifically set in East Anglia for further nostalgia stoking? Ooh. Is East Anglian themed media a thing?
Niche.
But a niche with some things in it.
Yeah, we were surprised actually when we started thinking about this that there are like a few, right?
Yeah, so first, obviously, Detectorists.
Yeah, Detectorists, which is, I believe, set in northern Essex but filmed in Suffolk, which is in East Anglia. And and northern Essex is very near East Anglia.
Yes, exactly. It's in that bulgy bit on the side of the country, which is East Anglia, right? So yeah, obviously, watch Detectorists. There's a Stephen Fry programme that is repeated a lot on ITV3 or something, called Kingdom.
This is a classic Caroline recommendation.
In which he plays, it's from like 2005, something around that time, and he plays like a solicitor in a small Norfolk seaside town.
Okay, that's a good one.
And there's lots and lots of shots of fields and stuff. I believe the opening credits have a very nice montage of East Anglia, so you might like that. And then, of course, Alan Partridge.
Yeah, famously Norfolk-based.
Famously Norfolk, East Anglian-based. If you're American, I feel like you might not know who Alan Partridge is. In a nutshell, it's a character played by Steve Coogan that has appeared in a lot of different shows. Knowing Me, Knowing You, I'm Alan Partridge. It was in some of the day-to-day, like, it's a character he's been doing for like 20 years and I think he hates it now.
But anyone else with any more East Anglian themed programmes?
Yeah, I feel like we've probably missed something really obvious, so please do correct us.
Get in touch. Moving on to the first thing we're going to talk about this week. The Hollow Crown, The Wars of the Roses, is a BBC series of Shakespeare adaptations. Following on from 2012's adaptation of the Henriad, the series sees Shakespeare's first tetralogy, which is Henry VI, Part 1, 2 and 3, and Richard III, dramatised in sequence over 3 episodes. It stars every British actor going, including Benedict Cumberbatch, Sophie Okonedo, Hugh Bonneville, Sally Hawkins and Tom Sturridge.
I do but dream on sovereignty. Like one that stands upon a promontory and spies a far off shore. So do I wish for the crown.
Hark what discord follows.
I am the queen!
It's a kind of panoply of, everyone who went to RADA, basically.
Yeah. So the episode aired on Saturday. It's an hour and 50 minutes. And from what I could tell, it's part one and part two of Henry VI.
Yeah. It's a little bit confusing if you are familiar with the plays to work out exactly where you are, because they've sort of mashed them up a little bit. They've cut lots of bits.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, they have stitched together plays, which if you saw them in the theatre would be separate plays.
Yeah.
Although you do sometimes see them. I saw the Henry IV plays at the Globe a few years ago, and they had combined, it was like one very long day. In the afternoon I saw Henry IV parts 1 and 2, and then in the evening part 3. Which was a long day, but they'd made a lot of cuts in part 1 and 2 in order to make them like 1 2.5 hour play, basically.
Okay, cool. So, which is basically what they've done with this.
Yeah, not dissimilar.
It's not quite 2 hours, and I feel like it was dead halfway through that one play finished and another play started, so I think they did pretty well there. If anyone's unfamiliar with these plays, the history plays are never my favourite Shakespeare plays.
No.
I sort of avoided them quite a lot when I studied Shakespeare at school and at university, but I would sort of hesitantly say that the lead character in this is not Henry VI but Gloucester. Would you agree?
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
So in the first two plays, Gloucester is basically Henry VI's like first-hand man. He's the protector, because Henry VI came to the throne so young, he needed someone to sort of make actual monarchical decisions. And he is like very, very loyal, and that's basically his entire character, is like loyal to the king till the end. Marvellously played in this by Hugh Bonneville, which is just like the perfect casting.
It's fantastic, because you've got a lot of actors in this who are really eminent Shakespeareans, people like Judi Dench and Anton Lesser and people like that.
Mm-hmm.
Hugh Bonneville, for all that I think he's a very talented actor, is not an eminent Shakespearean. You know, he is best known for Lord Grantham in Downton Abbey and the guy from 2012/W1A, and being in the Paddington film.
Yeah,
he is a light comic actor who can sometimes cry.
Yes, I think that's a good description. I also, my favourite thing about Hugh Bonneville is that he's like earnestness personified.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, he is not capable of playing a character that, for example, might have to lie or do anything that involves more than one facial expression at a time.
Definitely.
Like, he can only do one thing, like look shocked or look hurt or look indignant. And that's perfect for this character, because the character the whole time is just like, me? Betray my king?
Never. Yes, he does that a lot. And he's really good at looking very intensely at props as well.
Yeah.
He really invests in that. So like, there's a great bit right at the very start when, you know, Henry V has just died. He's died young. He's been a great king. He's led England to great victories at Agincourt and stuff.
Very patriotic, head-shaking territory.
Yeah, exactly. You know, his coffin is all flag draped in a chapel in Westminster Abbey, and the crown of the title is resting on top, and it's Hugh Bonneville's job to pick it up and walk out of the chapel into another one and then put it on a cushion.
Yeah.
And he's got some like stirring Shakespeare to say while he's doing this, but he's just so invested in holding that bit of plastic or whatever it is that you really believe it. It's great.
My other favourite Hugh Bonneville moments in this are another bit right at the beginning where Prince Henry is going to be crowned, but they sort of skirt around the lines in Shakespeare that imply that he's too young to be a proper king. Hugh Bonneville like goes into a room where the prince is, and like you turn around and there's like a woman holding a tiny baby, and Hugh Bonneville like turns shockedly and looks at the baby and just goes, "Your Majesty." Like, from the beginning, when Henry VI is a baby, he's still just like, I love you, King. I'll do anything for you, sir. Yeah, it's brilliant.
The history behind this is really complicated and really difficult to understand. It's not really a period that we massively study in school.
Well, I did it like early secondary school and primary school because there were a few battles around where I live from the Wars of the Roses. So it was a bit like we would dress up and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, no, I never did that. It went on for like 100 years. It was two aristocratic factions descended from the same like Plantagenet ultimate
line.
Progenitor, yeah. Fighting over who had the better claim to the throne / who had the biggest army / the most money. Lots and lots of people died unnecessarily. But the important point is one had the emblem of the White Rose and one of the Red Rose, York and Lancaster. And that is really what this is about. But everyone in it has a name of a place.
Yeah, it's a bit complicated. And also in this adaptation, they've tried to simplify it by like merging quite a few different characters. So Suffolk and Somerset, although there is someone called Somerset and someone called Suffolk in this, they're basically merged characters. Yeah. But they sort of quite hammily explain stuff to you. There's a great scene with the roses in the quad of Gloucester Cathedral, which is, again, near where I'm from. And it's also the Transfiguration Courtyard in Harry Potter, so you will recognise it.
Oh, yes, I didn't realise, but yes, it is. Yes. Yeah.
So there's a scene there where they've put, like, a big rose bush right in the centre
of
the Transfiguration
of
Courtyard. And then one by one, they, like, pick off a red rose and a white rose and, like, choose their sides. And they, like, have a big, useful family tree on screen at several shots. So I think they do a fairly good job of being, like, this was the basic argument between these people. They don't go for, like, long swathes of explanatory Shakespeare speeches.
No,
that instead
is good.
They just sort of visually do it.
That is good, which is, I guess, you can do on TV that you can't do on stage. So
yeah.
that's a good use of the medium. Generally, I thought the sort of televisual / cinematic aspects of this were really good.
Mm.
Like the very opening shot where it's like a helicopter shot over the White Cliffs of Dover, zooming in to like a man galloping on a horse along a cliff. And then at one point, doesn't he like jump a fence and there's a rose bush next to the fence and stuff.
It's all really, really hammy, which I think is perfect. I would have been so disappointed if this had been a very, very worthy production. But instead, they really just ramp up the drama. Like, for example, they really hammed up the battle scenes by cutting between the two different speeches. So you get Joan of Arc's speech and you get like the English battle leader's speech cut between each other. So you get that more like cinematic style of suspense building. But also just all the performances are just really, really hamming up the drama. Sally Hawkins as Gloucester's wife is like really sort of crazed and really overambitious. And I thought Tom Sturridge did an excellent naivety in his Henry VI. He's just like all the time like sort of doing a little boyish giggle and looking around for help. And that sort of, that character develops quite well. The only actor really doing a sort of more subtle performance, I thought, was Sophie Okonedo, who was really, really good.
That is interesting because Margaret of Anjou is a very difficult character, I think.
And one that you can ham up.
You really can
ham
up. You can make her seem a kind of bloodthirsty, distrustful wastrel or whatever. But you can also, and I think she's done this much better, you can also portray her as a kind of reluctant female Machiavelli. She's thrust into having to make decisions kind of beyond her purview because her husband is young and then also not interested in being king, and it's implied like a bit mad.
They do quite well in keeping the camera on her off dialogue in a way that they probably didn't need to in terms of they had to cut so much for this. And I think it just fills out that performance a little bit and stops it from becoming like, ooh, yep, evil, sex-driven woman.
Yeah, I think that's really good. And she's obviously a great actress. If you haven't been watching Undercover, then you should be. One thing I wanted to mention, though, is because obviously the history plays are just like full of men because the history is full of men. Other than like Margaret and a couple of other characters, I think I'm hoping in the second episode we're going to get more of Elizabeth of York, Edward IV's wife, because she's really interesting.
Yeah, we've just sort of seen her. They did quite well in they took a York soliloquy and cut it up between him and his wife so that they were having a conversation, which obviously feels much more natural for TV.
So writing for the NS a couple of years ago, Helen Lewis said a really interesting thing in a review of three Shakespeare plays that were on in London at the same time. She said, this new golden age of Shakespeare is also a golden age of 30-something and early 40-something actors. actors doing a hero alongside their more commercial work in a kind of mid-career seriousness test.
We've had David Tennant and Benedict Cumberbatch doing Hamlet, and we've had Martin Freeman doing Richard whoever.
Richard III, Jude Law did Henry V,
yeah.
Tom Hiddleston did Coriolanus. There's just a constant conveyor belt of, as she says, actors in a kind of mid-career who've...
And they're all posh.
They're all really posh, who've got another... more commercial line to their work. Like, they're in The Avengers, they're in Sherlock, they're in...
Yeah.
What did you think of Cumberbatch's Richard III?
Well, I feel like we barely saw him in this
episode.
Well,
he's not really in the first one. Yeah. I guess he's going to be in it way more by the end, because the third episode, I think, is entirely Richard III.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll reserve judgment, because I don't want to be like, yeah, I thought it was shit, because I hate Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what he does with the kind of stereotypical Richard III attributes.
Hashtag problematic.
Yeah, well, Shakespeare is credited with a lot of the like, making Richard evil stuff, isn't he? Down history. And I think lots of actors have made different decisions about how they portray that. My personal favourite is Kevin Spacey when he played Richard at the Old Vic a few years ago. Wore a kind of Victorian brace exoskeleton thing that was like all up his legs and up his back. And
was it set in that sort of period of Victorian?
Not really.
Oh, right. Just went for it.
Just went for it. And made a very kind of extravagant show of the fact that he couldn't really walk. And even at one point, like, fell face forward onto the stage from standing height, and then delivered one of the really famous speeches, like, without even being able to move his head properly, which was, you know, a really impressive feat of physical acting.
Did it feel more sympathetic or less?
More, I thought.
Okay.
More, because, and I actually quite liked that as a motivation, because he made the physical difficulties of being disabled at that time so apparent that you could sort of, I felt like I understood more than ever why Richard was so angry.
Well, I felt before I started watching this that it was going to be a real slog, and I was a bit like, great, Anna, like, better read up on the history plays. And like, I opened the Wikipedia page and it was like, Henry VI Part 1 is considered the worst of Shakespeare's plays. And I was like, great, really up for this ride. And then I loved it, and I'm actually really keen both to watch the rest of this series and to go back and watch the first one, because I never saw that. So I think it's, yeah, definitely worth a watch.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Now we're going to talk about a podcast. Not By Accident is a documentary series produced by Sophie Harper, telling the story of her decision to have a baby by herself via IVF, and then her life as a single parent living in Denmark. It's released in fortnightly installments, and there have been 3 out so far.
I'm 42, and my little girl Astrid will be 3 in a couple of weeks. The day after my 38th birthday, I called a clinic and booked myself in for an appointment to talk about choosing a donor and getting pregnant. I was single and 38 was my cutoff in my own mind. I knew if I didn't do it then, it would be too late.
She's an interesting presence. She sort of speaks very softly.
Her delivery is very quiet. I find it quite mesmerising.
She hasn't got loads of peaks and troughs in her voice. Like, it's fairly monotone. But then quite quickly, because it's got all this soothing music in the background and stuff as well, you do become quite, like, hooked.
I think it totally makes sense when you realise that she, her sort of main job is she's a documentary filmmaker and she also teaches film. That it's such a textured, layered experience in a way that you don't necessarily normally get with a podcast. Most podcasts are like this, us sitting in a room, talking into microphones, doing minimal...
Occasionally doing a clip.
doing minimal sort of like effects on it, basically. But hers is, there's lots of original music on it. She recorded all the major events.
Almost everything.
Almost everything. It's obviously just a sort of compulsion with her. Even when the audio isn't great quality, she uses it like in the background for atmosphere.
Yeah, she'll like start speaking over it like, oh, it's loud in this cafe, but I was telling Natasha, no. And you get a real sort of textured sense of her world and her life.
And
at
it
the
really
time.
Transports you. It's really good. And as I say, very unusual for like a free podcast on the internet. Some of the storytelling I find quite deliberately obtuse.
Yeah, she does. She sort of starts with her insemination and then she goes way back in the next episode to how she decided to make that decision, and like she hops around in time quite a lot so that sometimes you're quite confused about certain elements of her life.
Yeah, so it is a podcast that I think she says this at the beginning of the second or third one. She said, if you're just finding this, I really recommend you go back and listen to the first one. And that's what I would highly recommend this to listeners. It is really good. The episodes are very tightly edited and short. They're like 15, 20 minutes max. But you really need to start at the beginning. So maybe think of it almost like a kind of serialized audiobook.
It sort of unfolds in a non-linear but interesting way that way. So it's nice to stick to it.
Yeah, and I think it's a really interesting subject. I'm keen to know how far it's going to go, because in the kind of intro, she says, Not By Accident is a podcast about my decision to become a single mother and then how I coped with being one.
Yeah, whereas we're sort of nowhere near birth yet,
yeah,
are we?
We're still like in the first trimester of pregnancy, going back to a really harrowing bit about how leading up to her decision to do it. I think she was 38 when she got pregnant.
Yeah.
In the years before that, like her mother had had a really horrific experience with cancer not long after she, Sophie herself, found out that she had melanoma and had to have surgery for it. And they basically just as a family, they'd been through a really, really horrible time.
Yeah. But and I think it was a sort of like, oh, I actually need to live my life. Sort of moment.
Yeah, definitely. Sort of against the odds, they both come through it. And yeah, she decides, you've always wanted to do this, so just really start doing it, which is kind of sad, but also inspiring, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think it's really nice to hear about single motherhood from an older woman, because I feel like single motherhood is something that you immediately associate with, yes, perhaps maybe accidental pregnancy or the guy ran off and I decided I was still going to keep it. And it's something that seems to be like a mid-20s sort of thing.
It's also not something we ever think about as a choice, I think.
Yeah.
Whether it's, accidental pregnancy or being... a relationship breakup or being abandoned or whatever, it's always you're a single parent in spite of what you intended to happen, not because in Sophie's case she decided I want to do this and
I want to do it by myself.
I want to do it by myself. I'm also interested whether she's going to talk any more about the sort of political and legal context in which she's done this, because she lives in Denmark, which is a very progressive country when it comes to things like fertility and parental leave from jobs. It's just generally a kind of high tax, high welfare state, so there's lots and lots of support. So
she did say, sort of as an aside at one point, didn't she, where she was like on the bus to get inseminated and she was like, oh, I felt thankful that I lived in a country with great fertility tourism.
You know, there are lots of clinics, they're all well funded, they're all safe, there are lots and lots of donors. And it also, it's not exceptional, it's all just a very normal part of society, so she didn't have to kind of, well, we haven't heard much about this yet, but you feel like she hasn't really had to tackle a lot of stigma or put in an enormous amount of effort to find the one clinic in the country that does it. You know? So this is kind of, you feel like, a story that probably couldn't happen everywhere.
Definitely.
I'm not sure that, for instance, you'd be able to do it so easily in Britain, definitely not in America.
Yeah.
It's very interesting for that, and I hope she's going to go into that a bit more. I think she probably will once she gets to the point of like having to give up work for a bit and all that kind of thing. I'm also very interested to know how people are going to react to this podcast. I mean, I've seen it recommended lots of places. It's definitely getting some traction.
Because I think she's got a bit of a profile already, hasn't she? So I think people are aware of her. But yeah, I don't know. I think I can't imagine it would be anything negative, because it's just such a lovely, A, listening experience, and B, just like a really great story. Because there's every point you just feel like, oh my God, yes, you are so lucky that your mother lived to see you have a child, and you are so lucky that you've been able to do this, and you are clearly going to be such a great mum because you want this so much. All of that stuff, it just feels overwhelmingly positive to me.
Yeah, and I mean, I know there are rules in America, and I think in Britain as well, like when it comes to adopting, for instance, that you are less likely to get allocated a child if you're a single parent. You know, you're supposed to be like a stable couple owning a house, etc., etc. So I think, yeah, there is kind of an element to which her story is unusual, but not because people don't want to do it.
Yeah, no, I think it's really interesting, so we'll see what the reaction is like.
Sometimes these walls seem to cave in on me, but when I look in your eyes, I feel alive.
So last week I recommended that Caroline watch Cry Baby, a 1990 American teen musical romantic comedy spoof from The Strange Mind of John Waters. It follows good girl Allison, who falls for bad boy Wade Crybaby Walker, and joins their gang of juvenile delinquents.
It's a place where the pleasures are simple.
You want to ride home with Dad? We can count out-of-state license plates.
Kids help their parents.
He not only vacuums, he does windows.
And squares get the girls.
We'll get married and live in suburbia.
Then Crybaby Walker.
Yeah! You're looking to rumble, you're looking at me, cause I'm a king.
Caroline, major thoughts?
This film is amazing.
Oh, I'm so glad you love it.
I loved it so much and really want to watch it again immediately, because I think I was so busy the first time being like, no, not again, not more, that I definitely missed like more joy to be had from it.
It's just so over the top that I think a first watch can be like utterly overwhelming.
Yes, it was. I was so kind of right from the very beginning when the kind of opening credits happen over this montage of everyone in the high school queuing up to get their polio vaccinations.
Yeah, I love that scene.
And I was so busy like laughing myself silly at like all of the contorted expressions they do when they get vaccinated that I don't think really picked up on all the like things he's seeding in there about the various different like high school gangs and stuff.
Yeah, there's like a great bit where my favourite of the delinquents, Wanda, gets her shot and she does this very sexual sort of shiver. And it's all so completely overblown, but really, really funny.
And then just everything from like the cars and the leather jackets, it feels a bit like Grease in some places.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mockery of Grease,
although
it?
Yeah, obviously it's taking the piss and it goes much, much further as well. But like the, you know, the car they've got flames all down the side.
Yeah.
And all that kind of thing, so you feel like you're in familiar territory, but then every so often John Waters just chucks something in to completely floor you, like the fact that Johnny Depp is called Crybaby.
And he's got a tattoo of a teardrop on his face. What did you think of Johnny Depp in this?
He looks so young.
So young.
So young.
This is one of his first roles after being like a teen pin-up in 21 Jump Street. And it was really like an opportunity for him to mock himself. And I think he was very like grateful for it at the time.
Yeah, you can see that actually, that he is kind of undercutting the whole like matinee idol thing in a way that is very pleasing, and I think probably so his motivation and John Waters kind of align for this film,
definitely.
Which is definitely good. Yeah, I found him ridiculous, but in a really adorable way.
There's so many great lines in it and scenes, but I love, all my teenage heart especially loved the scene where they're sort of drag racing on the streets, like the big sort of racing finale, where they're like overtaking the good girl and her, so Allison, who's like, you know, part of some country club, and her mum and her boyfriend are all in the car, and then Johnny Depp and his like gang of crazy like rebellious teens swing by in their car with the flame on the side, and they like sing to her they're driving on the wrong side of the road so that they can be parallel with her car. And I love that scene because it is it's like obviously a complete joke, but at the same time it is quite like, oh, and Johnny Depp is still really handsome and actually singing this song, and it is cute. But yeah, did you like the music in it?
I did. I really liked it. I like how period appropriate it all was.
Mm-hmm.
It's all very like 50s rock and roll.
Yeah.
It's really good.
And it also in that sort of Grease like musical way.
Yes. I also found Alison really funny. How she just doesn't ever break from her like really earnest desire to like do a bad thing.
The Hugh Bonneville of the movie,
yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah, she is. Like, there's that scene when she and Johnny Depp are making out on a picnic blanket.
Yes, I love that scene where she's like, I'm not going to get mononucleosis, Emma. And he's like, no.
And then a tree gets struck by lightning. And then she says something really weird, like, he says, like, are you scared? And she says, no, it's kind of sexy.
I also love her scene where she like sobs in bed over her like heartbreak, and she's like, she cries into a jar and like collects all her tears in a jar labeled tears, and then at the end of the song she drinks it.
Oh, so weird.
It makes you feel so weird, but it's also such a great like image for that like girl drowning in her own misery like quite happily.
Just generally the whole film is such a joyful experience, and I'm kind of mad that I'd never even heard of it.
Yeah, it's I feel like evangelical about this film because it is so funny and like such a, I think it would be a great watch if you like had all your girlfriends around and wanted to watch something silly like that. But be warned, you might accidentally get hooked on the soundtrack thinking that you were enjoying it in an ironic fashion and then find that actually...
Oh no, I'm definitely just enjoying it. Like there's no ironic about it. I mean, an illustration of this is right at the very end, so you know, close your ears if you don't want to know what happens when they're doing the final showdown with the cars.
Yeah.
And the guys are like on top of the cars, it's all rah,
yeah,
rah.
Yeah.
And then she gets on the back of the motorcycle and her skirt gets ripped away, so she looks extra sexy.
Yeah.
And then she like flies through the air for a really really long time, and obviously John Waters does this deliberately because he's a genius, but it like cuts to loads of different people's faces just like really passively watching the sky for a really long time until you're just like, come on, what is happening, is she still in the air, how is this going on? And at that point I was like, no, you're not feeling ironic about this at all, you're just really invested in this.
Lots of great random cameos as well from like Ricky Lake and Iggy Pop. And,
oh yeah, Iggy Pop's in it.
Yeah, it's just really, it's like a constant delight, I think. So do watch that. So Caroline, can you match that?
I don't think so. I don't
thank yourself, babe.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just a very different type of film that I'm going to recommend you. It's called 20 Feet from Stardom.
Okay.
It came out, I think, 2-3 years ago. It's a documentary. It's not a
change
film.
Of pace. Good.
Change of pace. And I found it really joyful, although it definitely has a kind of darker, sadder side. It's about backup singers.
Oh, yeah.
So women who've sung backup for some of the biggest stars in the world, like the Rolling Stones and Michael Jackson and Stevie Wonder and all
wicked.
These kind of people. They've toured with all of these people. They've lived the rock and roll lifestyle in a sense. They've made some amazing music, but they've never been the star.
Mm.
And a lot of them have had attempts to have solo careers or do other stuff, and it's just never quite taken off. And they've always ended up like standing at the back of the stage while Mick Jagger's jumping around in the front and getting cheered, you know?
So did this, I feel like this got some award nominations.
Yeah, I think it might have been nominated at the Oscars.
Yeah, I think I have heard about this.
I'm
okay,
not sure.
Cool.
But it's a really interesting film. There's also, I think I might, if you have time, recommend you, there's an episode of the Death, Sex and Money podcast, which has an in-depth interview with one of the women,
yeah.
In which she talks about how very little financially she benefited from decades of touring with a worldwide famous band.
That's so bad.
Which is really interesting.
Cool. I can't wait. Definitely check that out. Thanks for listening to Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to Seriously. All you have to do is search SRSLY in iTunes or any other podcasting app you use. While you're there, it would be really great if you could leave us an iTunes review, as it helps other people find the show.
We also rely on you listeners for your recommendations. So if you want to tell us what you thought about something, or if you've got something we should watch, you can contact us on Twitter, Facebook, via email. All the details are on seriouslypodcast.com. If you like, you can also recommend us to your friends, family, neighbours, strangers. Let them know that you like the podcast and that they should be listening to it too.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.